Let us begin. So I, for the sake of history, let me just take 2 minutes and explain what that was. When Rabbi Soloveitchik's wife was alive, they used to spend their summers in Cape Cod in Onset. In fact, I just today looked online, and the synagogue is still there. You can see it, capecodshul.org. And right on the homepage, it says, our little synagogue founded in the 1940s was Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik's summer shul for many years. It's right near the water, and he used to go there. When his wife passed away, he was very lonely and depressed, and there were some people in the Boston community, in particular a woman named Feuerstein. I think her first name was Shirley, actually, the wife of Mo Feuerstein, who recently passed away. He was a big macher in the OU. In fact, their son is the rabbi of Livingston, New Jersey, which is right near where I live, and his wife passed away. I think he's still sitting Shiva, Mordechai Feuerstein. But so she arranged that a group of young men, Smicha students, would come and study with Rabbi Soloveitchik in the summer. And this went on from the late 60s. In fact, some of you might have heard the famous story of Rabbi Soloveitchik wanted to teach the students Tanya. One year, and the students refused. They didn't want to learn that, and he saw that as they just wanted to learn Gemara, and he saw that as a sign of their lacking religious feeling, that they didn't study Tanya. That took place, I think it was 69 or 70, 1970, in the summer, and even people who were not his regular students went there. Then later on, they set up this summer thing for a few days where rabbis from all over America would come. Called it the Arche Kala. I was actually in that the last summer he did it. It was the summer of 85. The story is really very simple. I was in Israel that year at BMT, and from 84 to 85, 5 years ago, 26 years ago, and I didn't know what to do that summer. And Rabbi Alan Brill was my Harusa. He's a name that I'm sure some of you know. And he suggested he was going to go to the Boston Colo in the summer, so he suggested I go. And lo and behold, my parents were actually that summer at Brandeis. So I had a place to stay, and I had use of a car, so I went there, and I think it was the whole July. I would go every day. It was at the Young Israel Brookline. And I still remember everyone there was in the Smicha program already, with the exception of one person, I think, either was already a rabbi or was in Smicha. One person was not, and then there was me. I was only 18 at the time. The person running it was Rabbi Yair Kahn, who, if I'm not mistaken, now teaches at Gush. So Rabbi Chaim, in those days, Howard Jachter, he wasn't a rabbi then, he was there. And he comes in, like, the first day or the second day, Rabbi Soloveitchik would come give class twice a week. And he needs someone to help drive Rabbi Soloveitchik. I don't know, I figured there'd be a fight to help him out, because you needed to carry him. Well, you didn't carry him, but you had to put your arms through him and basically hold him up, because it was very difficult for him to walk. And lo and behold, no one volunteered to do it. I guess they were already in the Rav Shir. It wasn't a big deal for them, but I thought that this is an amazing opportunity to go back and forth. It was only 5 minutes each way. And I said last week that I drove him, and I do believe one time I drove him in my car, but most of the times it was, if not virtually every time, it was in Chaim Jachter's car. And each time, I still remember it, we get in the car and at the Tversky's house, and you had 5 minutes, not even 5 minutes. So immediately Rabbi Jachter would start with the questions, ask, he would sit in like 30 seconds, how are you, how was your night, etc., did you sleep well? And then he'd start in with the questions, and lots of interesting things, including one that I don't want to repeat, although I know you'd find it interesting, but since this is on tape, you can ask me privately, I'll tell you. I wouldn't publish it either, because I feel it's sort of interfering into the family life of the Soloveitchik clan. Suffice it to say that he expressed some displeasure at the path of one of his grandsons who was not following in his path. That is, he should go to the army, and at the time I didn't know who that grandson was. So it was a great experience. That was actually the time, this has even been written up, where I also asked some questions, and one of them was about Thanksgiving, since we're coming to Thanksgiving, where I asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, because I had heard that he observed Thanksgiving, and this was before Rakim. Hefet wrote up everything, and Rav Shechter and Nefesh HaRav wrote about it, and other people wrote about it. There was nothing in print. But, you know, people heard that he liked Thanksgiving. So I asked him, and he couldn't understand how anyone would have a problem with Thanksgiving. And I said to him, without saying who said this, that, well, some people say because it started with a Christian holiday. And he cut me off and said, are you going to church? And I said, no. He said, so why are you worried about this? We don't go to church on Thanksgiving. So that was quite interesting. One more thing from that summer, which was the last summer. He gave shiur then the fall of 85, and that was it. So he didn't anymore. He was ill. I still recall also very vividly that, because anyone here who's been to yeshiva knows that when the Rebbe speaks, if you have something to say, you raise your hand, you interrupt, you ask a kasha, and I was using a Steinsaltz. That was because we were learning Sanhedrin. So the Rav starts reading a Rashi, and he reads it, he punctuates it differently than Steinsaltz. That is, he puts a comma somewhere else, and he gives a different shot than the Rashi. So immediately I start, you know, to call out, to say something to, you know, like I would if I was in regular class, to say, no, there's a different way of reading it. And then I held myself back, you know, here, this is the Gadol Hador, and I'm going to be telling him, you know, he should read it like Steinsaltz. But true story. A couple other things. This goes back to what Yisrael mentioned last week. Coincidentally, 2 days after we spoke about the Rambam last week, I saw the following by a learned person who tells this story. After he put out, there's a book, Mor Nevuchim, on the Torah. You can buy it in Sfarim stores. He takes all the passages in the Mor Nevuchim and puts it up with the Psukim. So, for example, when the Rambam discusses, we had it a couple weeks ago, Vayera, how this story was a dream. It's not really that the actual angels come to Abraham and at his tent. So if you look in Parshas Vayera, that's what you'll have there, as well as all throughout the Mor Nevuchim, the Rambam is explaining what this word means or this verse. So it's a very nice work, and Mosada Rav Kook published it. So he writes as follows, that after I published this, I met with people from Art Scroll. I wanted to publish the Mor Nevuchim in an English translation. I don't know if this person is American or English, an Englishman, but he wanted to publish with Art Scroll an English Mor Nevuchim, I guess with commentary, however they would do it. And this is what he says. After they examined the matter, Achar shebatku et hatzara im Harav Feinstein, a ben shel Rav Moshe. He doesn't say which son of Rav Moshe Feinstein. I assume it's Rav David Feinstein, because if you look in the Art Scroll, in the Art Scroll Chumash, they're always quoting Rav David Feinstein. That's their connection, and obviously the people who run Art Scroll have a connection to Rav David Feinstein. So after they discussed it with Rav David Feinstein, the answer they gave me was no, and this is the reason, quote, a sefer Mor Nevuchim a no ra'oi lehikanes ait charedi. That the Mor Nevuchim is not a book that should be found in a Haredi household. So, Yitzhak, if that answers your question, very good. I'm not sure. Menikah, the Mor Nevuchim on the Rambam? I'm not sure what you mean by that. Or if that, you're talking about the Gemara. The Steinsaltz Gemara. Okay, one more thing before we go on. We spoke a few times. Unless Bill Gewirtz is not with us. If he's with us, he's here. So, Bill Gewirtz tells the story, which has been repeated in Nefesh HaRav, that Rav Soloveitchik said that it's forbidden to be stupid, according to the Torah. And I made a whole thing that maybe this is a joke. I always assumed it was a joke, and Bill was a witness to what happened. It has to do with bowing before karate or judo. Someone asks, is the Rav, is it permissible? He says, no. And the person starts saying, well, why not? What's wrong with it? It's not a vote of zar. And he says, it's not because of vote of zar. It's because of, it's stupid. Okay. Now, Shlomo called my attention to the fact that in this book, the Rav thinking aloud, he uses the exact same formulation. I knew this passage, but I forgot. I give a talk, was the Rav really a good Zionist? And I try to show that all of his public persona was, and he was, obviously, he was a member of Mizrahi, but sometimes when he got very upset or when a certain mood, feelings came out which were really brisk, not Zionism. And I say that you could take the man out of brisk, you can't take brisk out of the man. And in this book here, you really have some non, even anti-Zionist stuff. And one of them is when he gets very angry when the students do a whole Yom HaTzma'ut ceremony with Haftar. They take out, they do all sorts of things, and he gets very angry. And he says that the program they had, which Chadodi at Kabbalah, almost like Kabbalah Shabbos, the night before Yom HaTzma'ut. He says that this is, he says, boys who are B'nai Torah, who can understand the Gemara, Tosos, or Rashba, why should they follow such nonsense? No Averos, no Isurin, but it's forbidden to act like a fool. So where does this come from? This summer, I was reading a work by Yehoshua Munshein. I don't know how many of you know the name. He works in the library of Hebrew University. Manuscripts or something like that. Not in the actual library, but in one of the collections of manuscripts or old books, something like that. And he knows everything there is to know about Hasidus. Not just the Alois Chabad, he knows everything about everything. And he's been in battles, by the way, with this David Kamenetsky, who's also an author about the phone and other things. But he has an article, it was also translated into English, and appears in a very good book published by Lippmann Library all about Hasidut, the proceedings of a conference about 50 years ago in London. And he has an article there called Fluidity of Categories on Hasidism, which for the most part deals with Aveiro Lishma, you know, sinning for a higher purpose, those sorts of things. And there's another thing I want to tell you from this, but I won't get to it today. But on page 310, he states that he quotes the saying attributed to Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, that, quote, to be a fool is prohibited from the Torah. So what's the Rav saying? The Rav's saying it's forbidden to do something foolish according to the Torah. It's forbidden to do something stupid. And now we see that this goes back. I don't know whether it's actually true that Shneur Zalman said it, but it's attributed to him, and it's an old Chabad tradition that the Alter Rebbe said that it's forbidden from the Torah to be a fool. And if I had to guess, I would assume that this goes back to Rav Soloveitchik's youth. He probably heard it. We all know that he had a Chabad tutor, a Chabad Melamed. That year, he said he didn't learn any Gemara because the Melamed only taught him Talmud. But it could be that this famous expression of Rav Soloveitchik, that it's forbidden to be a fool, it's forbidden to act stupid, that this goes back to his Chabad training. Okay, so let us now continue with the person we're focusing on, great Rabbi Eliyahu Ben Amozik. This picture again. If you recall, I ended last class with his defense of Kabbalah, his attack on Shadal, or Shmuel David Lasato. And for some reason, I lost certain of my pictures, the title pages, but we already saw it last week, so I don't need to show you his attack on Shadal. And the last thing I said, or one of the last things, was that he said that, and yes, Shadal, if you can prove to me that the Zohar really is a medieval composition, it wouldn't affect matters in the slightest, because Kabbalah and the Zohar are not identical. Kabbalah is the ancient Jewish system, and the Zohar is a Kabbalistic text. And if you're going to tell me that it's written in medieval times, but the ideas go back, or we don't want to deal with it at all, it doesn't really matter. Kabbalah doesn't rise or fall on the Zohar. Then we spoke about Gilgal, reincarnation, which is an essential element of Kabbalah, and I ended by discussing the dispute whether Josephus is referring to reincarnation. But it's not just for Josephus. In his book, Emat Matgia, which is against Yehuda Le Aryeh Mimudna, this is in volume 2, also page 2b, he says that the Talmud itself recognizes a reincarnation. How does the Talmud recognize reincarnation? No one before Ben Amozig ever said the Talmud recognizes reincarnation. In fact, the greatest opposition to reincarnation was precisely that you don't have it anywhere in the Talmud. Not even, well, you have death, obviously. You have the world to come. But the idea that you're reincarnated, you have resurrection, but the idea that you're reincarnated is found nowhere in the Talmud. And I mentioned last week that the Rishash, Rav Shmuel Strashon, who's found back of all the big Vilna Gemaras, on one passage, I can send you the, anyone who's interested, I'll send it to you. He says that he, after quoting a Talmudic passage, he says this shows that the Talmud didn't accept Gilgal. Obviously, this created a big controversy. I think some Hasidim actually cut out that passage in the Rashash. But Ben Amozig says something very interesting. There are a number of figures in the Talmud who are, my friend Rabbi Seth Farber, he's now well known for his work in Israel about conversion, but I go back a long time with him, and we used to play tennis together many, many years ago. But he coined a phrase, and I'll say the phrase unless I can get it exactly correct, but I can't get it. But basically, the upshot of it was that the Talmud takes, there's a limited repertoire of figures, and the Talmud likes to combine them all. So, for example, you will see that one Talmudic figure, Paro, is referred to later on as also being Eov. What do one have to do with the other? There's, like I said, there's a limited repertoire of figures. So these significant figures, you put them. So what's the story? He survived the Red Sea and he ends up as Eov. You have all these sorts of things. Cyrus is the same as Darius, is the same as others. He quotes another one here, Lot, Lot. We're reading this part of the year. Say about Lot. Forget who Lot is. I think maybe remember. I forgot who Lot is, but Lot is also one of these figures that ends up being someone else later on. Yeah, Koresh is Daryavash. And he says, what's going on here? How can anyone with any sense accept this, believe this? He says, are you going to say that the rabbis, even their opponents, know we're smart people, that they can have such a chisaron, v'shigaon, kokach atzum, that they can have such craziness to say that all these people who are clearly different people are really the same people? That's impossible. How can we accept these as possible, that Koresh is the same as Daryavash, or unfortunately, Lot is Paro, I don't even know, but you have all these expressions. Oh yeah, Hiram, who was in the time of Shlomo, he also is someone who was in the days of, Lavan is Bilam. That's what he says. So you have an Agada that says Lavan is really the same person as Bilam. I think most people who read the Maros mean that, and you find this even in traditional commentators, that obviously doesn't mean that Lavan is the same as Bilam. It means that they have the same characteristics, that you can look at one and see the other. Not that they mean that they're the same. But Ben Amozig says no. Talmud says they are the same. Doesn't mean that they just have the same characteristics, and obviously they can't be the same person because that doesn't make any sense. What it means is that spiritually they're the same. What does that mean? This is the reincarnation. Bilam is the reincarnation of Lavan. And he goes on and discusses this. That to him, and I don't think it's a good proof, but he's satisfied with it, and that to him is his great proof that the Talmud accepts reincarnation. His two proofs are the Talmud does, and also the passage in Josephus, which I mentioned, some people do think it means reincarnation, but Louis Feldman says it absolutely means resurrection. I'll read it to you again. Josephus says, the Pharisees believe that the souls of good men are removed into other bodies, but the souls of bad men are subject to eternal punishment. Feldman says this means resurrection, not reincarnation. Let's go on. What about what I said before, that there's, I not only said there's no reference to reincarnation in the Talmud, which Ben Amozig has just refuted, at least to his satisfaction, there's no mention of reincarnation in the Torah. And don't think this is a little matter. As I said, reincarnation is central to Kabbalah. can't have Kabbalah without reincarnation. It's sort of like you can't have Hinduism without reincarnation. Now, this is basic. You find it, and it's not just Zohar. You find it in the Ramban. You find it in all the classic Mekubalim. At the same time that you have the rationalists who say that it's forbidden to accept this, the Mekubalim say you're obligated to accept this. How does Ben Amozig reply to the fact that there's no mention of reincarnation in the Torah? He says there's no reference to lots of basic Jewish doctrines in the Torah. There is no reference in the Torah to immortality. Reference in the Torah to immortality of the soul, or to resurrection for that matter. No reference in the Torah to God being incorporeal. On the contrary, every reference in the Torah is that God is indeed corporeal. It never says anywhere in the Torah that God does not have a physical form. What it says is that God does have a physical form, and seeing it, it is dangerous to your health. Obviously, we interpret this as not being literal, but so Ben Amozig says, all these rationalists who oppose reincarnation, they say it's not mentioned in the Torah, they'd be the first ones to say that God is incorporeal, and yet you don't see this from the Torah, you don't see immortality or resurrection from the Torah. And the answer is that the Torah doesn't contain everything. We also have a tradition. And many of the most important things in our religion are not found in the Torah and are only part of a tradition by the sages which go back to the Torah. Why that is the case, that so many important things are not found in the Torah, that's a different discussion. But Ben Amozig takes it as a given, and he's right. I mean, the Rambam explains why there's no reference to God's incorporeality in the Torah, why the other things. But Ben Amozig's not interested in that at this moment. He's just interested in proving that everyone has to acknowledge that certain basic ideas are not found in the Torah. So he's very conservative in that area, but he does have some radical ideas. As any interesting figure is going to have some radical ideas. You find some of it in this book. His Mavo LaTorah Sheba'al Peh, a beautiful little blue volume here. What is this volume? I have another volume just like it I'll speak about. There is a rabbi in Haifa. His name is Zaini. Z-E-I-N-I. He's the rabbi of the Technion. Also, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Hesder Yeshiva, Orv Yeshua. They published some very good stuff. They just came out, if you read my blog, my Svarim blog post, they are the ones who published this new Chumash on Breishis of Rav Kook, which has Chumash and Rashi, and they take all of Rav Kook's writings and they combine them, and then they put them on the part of the verses of the Torah. He's also a big right winger politically. You have to see some of the things he writes. It's really pretty extreme. And from a stamp, and he's from Algeria, born in Algeria, so French is his first language. And as a thinker, he's very independent. On matters of halacha, he goes up against Rav Avad Yosef as no problem, which is very unusual for the Sephardic Rabbani. But he's a big chassid of Ben Amozig. And if you see here, titled the series, Kitvei HaRav Elia Ben Amozig. He's taken upon himself the task to publish all of Ben Amozig's writings, the ones that are in Hebrew, them out in beautiful new volumes like this. He's also published in French. He's written articles on it, as well as to translate from French into Hebrew. Ben Amozig also wrote in Italian. I don't know if Zaini knows Italian, but up till now he's only published in Hebrew two volumes. And this one, Mavo LaTorah Sheba'al Peh, itself quite fascinating. There was one of the first Hebrew periodicals was called Halavanon, Paris in the 19th century, the 1860s, I think, 1870s, 1880s. You can find it. The Hebrew University has a newspaper project. They're putting all the important Hebrew newspapers online, and the entire run of Halavanon is online. So in about 15 issues, 20 issues, they divided. This was a whole book which they put into, they serialized it. So you have Ben Amozig's Introduction to the Oral Law, full of insights. And you have here also Zaini's commentary, lengthy commentary, his notes. If you look on page 23 in this book, you will find Ben Amozig saying and proving, at least to his satisfaction, from Rashi on Gemara, that while the book of Deuteronomy was prophetically revealed, this only refers to the content. Moses was responsible for the actual words. This is not formally what you think of as the standard view. And whenever Ben-Amose has a view that's a little bit out of the ordinary, like we'll see soon, he says about the Essenes, Zaini will have a note explaining it. Nothing on this. And not only that, on the very same page, he argues that the Gezeirah Shavah is a form of hermeneutic, where there's two words that are the same or very similar, and you derive something from it. Traditionally, it's understood that whereas a Kal Vachomer, that is, when you go from minor to major, like if something is forbidden on Yom Tov, certainly it's forbidden on Shabbos. For that, we don't need a tradition for it. That anyone with a half a brain could figure it out. Maybe I'm being a little flippant there, but this could be figured out through Svara, through logic. The reason I say perhaps being flippant, because it's not always so clear what's Kal Vachomer. Maybe it goes the other way. There could be complicated things. But everyone assumes that a Kal Vachomer is something you can do on your own. But a Gezeirah Shavah, we're usually taught in yeshivas that this has to be done through a tradition, because otherwise you could create all sorts of chaos. Anyone could come up with a word and find another word, and who knows what you can come up with. However, Ben Amozig argues that no, the Gezeirah Shavah is not from Sinai, but this is from the authority of the rabbis. And this also, when I saw this, I was a bit surprised. And Zaini has a footnote on the spot where he says, although Rashi in many places says that the Gezeirah Shavah is a Masorah, a tradition, and he goes on, he says, Aval Rov Chachmei Dorot Chalku Alav. He says that most people disagree with Rashi and hold that no, that Gezeirah Shavah is not, doesn't have to be from a tradition. Goes and gives the proofs for this. Subsequently to that, I found that Rabbi Gedalia Nadel, he was a well-known student of Chazon Ish, published a book, Torah Tosha, Rabbi Gedalia, in which he has everyone focused on this book, because in this book he accepts evolution, talks about how the Torah should be reinterpreted, so something we take for granted maybe in the modern Orthodox world, but this is the Talmud Muvach, or a Talmud Muvach of the Chazon Ish, Posig in Bnei Brak, and for him to say that, that's quite unusual. But as far as I know, no one has taken note that also in this book, he says, and he not doesn't just say, he explains that a Gezeirah Shavah could also be from the independent authority of the rabbis on their own. They conclude this. And when you think about it a little, and you read what Nadel says, and you read Ben Amozig, when you get over the fact that you've been brainwashed in school, it's not strange at all. Because if Chazal have the authority to make drashot independently, their insight into the meaning of words, they basically create Judaism either through their tradition or through drashot. Most of what we do is through their drashot, independent of tradition. I'm talking about the mainstream view. The Rambam's position is more that all these drashot are not creative, but they're just mnemonic devices. But the standard view is that these drashot are really creations of the rabbi, so much so that the Ritva says that the Rambam's view is forbidden to believe it. He says it's minut or karovo minut, it's almost heresy, it is heresy, because if you look in the Gemara, you can't really make sense of the Gemara unless you assume that the rabbis are really creating drashot. So if the rabbis can create drashot, and they once asked Rav Soloveitchik about this when they're learning, how is it that, you know, what's going on here? Because there's an extra word, they say it means this. And he said, the rabbis have the authority to make drashot. So if the rabbis have the authority to make drashot, why can't they make a Gezeirah Shavah? What's the difference? There is no difference. Drashot are very similar to Gezeirah Shavah. In this volume, The Introduction to the Oral Law, well, first of all, it's designed to show the authenticity of the Oral Law. This is an era, he's writing it, in which the reformers, although they were not active in Italy, you didn't have a reform movement in Italy. Anyone who was up on what was going on knew about the reform movement. They were denying the validity of the oral tradition. You have in early Reform Judaism what can best be called Karaite tendencies. The late Jacob Petachovsky, a great Reform rabbi and thinker from an Orthodox background, his father was an Orthodox Rav, he wrote an article called Karaite Tendencies in Early Reform Liturgy or Early Reform Works, something like that. But the word Karaite Tendency, because you had all these Reform thinkers saying that, you know, the beauty of Judaism is in the Bible. You want to get back to the Bible. The rabbis have distorted everything. So what is that if not being a Karaite? It's not the only time we've had Karaite tendencies. You had some of these former conversos who came out of Portugal. They come to Amsterdam, and they rejected Christianity. And Christianity is in accordance with the Bible. In the Bible, is there a Trinity, the priesthood, all these things. They really have a biblical type of Judaism. They come to Amsterdam, and then they find out, wait a second, Judaism is not really biblical. Judaism is traditional Judaism, although obviously we use the Bible, it's really based on the oral tradition, because we do not read the Bible as the Bible. We read it through the eyes of the oral tradition. You can't take a Bible and just read it and know anything about what we need to do. Even things that you think you know, if it says, you can almost always assume that if it says X, it really means Y. Even something as basic as an eye for an eye, we know it doesn't mean an eye for an eye. And almost every single verse of the Torah has... we have to read it through the understanding of the rabbis and their understanding and their all these things. So you had a rebellion. You had some of these former conversos become like Karaites, biblicists, because they thought they come to they thought that they were being reunited with Judaism away from all these Catholic distortions, and instead they see there's other distortions that the rabbis are distorting everything. So. Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, who passed away early this year, he wrote about this, and others have as well. That's the Rambam's perspective, but others think otherwise. That Bill, that they—I mean, the mainstream view—and you can see in Jay Harris's book on the subject—is that you're really—it's creative. It's funny because in pre-modern times. Except for the Rambam, everyone assumes that drashot are really creative. In modern times, that's more problematic, because if you look at it, what are the rabbis doing here? And therefore, if you look at modern times, people like Rav W.C. Hoffman and all these Orthodox thinkers in modern times, they adopt the Rambam's position, that really everything is a tradition, and this is just mnemonic devices. With regard to Halacha Moshe Sinai, not always literal, that goes back to the Rush. They point out that in some places, so when it says Halacha Moshe Sinai, it doesn't mean it literal, it just means an ancient law. If you go to a place like Bar Ilan University today, they will assume that always, when I'm talking about Orthodox people, says Halacha Moshe Sinai, it's always an expression, it doesn't mean it literally. And their proofs are that sometimes in the Bavli, they see it as Halacha Moshe Sinai, in Yerushalmi, they don't see it that way at all. Oh, but traditionally, it's been understood as an oral tradition going way back, if not all the way back, to Moses of Sinai. But you already see, as I said, in Rishonim, some chipping away at the edges of this. This was the great dispute between Zachariah Frankel and Hirsch. Because Frankel assumes that Halacha Moshe Sinai always means an ancient tradition, as opposed to one going all the way back to Moses. And Hirsch attacks him for this. Today, it might seem to be a sort of arcane argument, really. What's the difference at the end of the day? If it's an ancient tradition going back thousands and thousands of years, even before Chazal, or if it goes all the way back to Moses, but that was the great dispute. All I can say is that if you look at the scholars, Orbach and Sakivat and all the Orthodox academic scholars, they assume that Frankel was correct on this matter. They all assume. Halivni is a big follower of Zachariah Frankel. Zachariah Frankel's problem, really, was that he lived 100 years too soon. He was very medakdek in mitzvos, complete believer in Torah Misinai. His difference was in how he viewed rabbis and halacha, and yet if you go to Bernard Revel Graduate School, if you go to Bar Ilan, if you go to any of the Orthodox scholars doing work in the Talmud, they all come down on Frankel's side in these areas. So that's what I mean when I say that he was born 100 years too soon. And Rabbi Yechiel Weinberg recognizes. Rabbi Yechiel Weinberg said that I mean, he was a big fan of Zacharia Frankel. He put Zichrono Livracha after his name, and he wrote a parish on Zeraim also. This parish is reprinted. It's a wonderful parish. But I'm talking about his introduction to the Yerushalmi, his introduction to the Mishnah. That's where it really comes from. Shaul Lieberman tells how he came to Eretz Yisrael. All he had been in were yeshivas. And he decides to enroll to study under Yaakov Nachum Epstein at the Hebrew University, the great scholar, great critical scholars of the 20th century. And the class that they're going to take is Introduction to Yerushalmi. And Lieberman told that, the class, the book he's assigned was Introduction to the Yerushalmi. Now, he had already learned through all of Yerushalmi. He knew all of Yerushalmi then. But he didn't understand. What do you mean, Introduction to Yerushalmi? Whoever heard of an introduction? Talmudic books don't have introductions. That was his first introduction to Zacharia Frankel. The real chidush, the real novelty of, or the point he's trying to make in this book, is that he argues that the Torah Shebaal Peh is not terminus, contemporaneous to the most, to the Torah Shebaal Peh. Most people assume that the written law and the oral law are of the same antiquity. The oral law given together with the written law. It's clear that you need some sort of oral tradition. I'm not saying this for dogmatic reasons. I'm just saying this for basic, even scholarly reasons, just common sense reasons. The Torah says, for example, you shall not work. And it doesn't explain what this work is. And then we know that working is you're punished for working. So you need to know what work is. The Torah speaks about a man divorcing a wife, but it doesn't tell you how you divorce. So all sorts of things needed to be given together with it. You can't write everything down. No law code has everything written down. Ben Amozig, however, says that the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral tradition, precedes the written law. The Torah as we have it today is a recording in print of God's word to Moses that previously existed in oral form. So the oral law precedes the written law, and the written law is only part of what was in existence as oral law. And Amozig didn't know this. Chai Gaon says basically the exact same thing, and in a posting of mine, I think not the next one, I think the next one after that, I'm going to quote this from Chai Gaon. But the written law is only a portion of the original Torah, this Platonic Torah, but this the Torah. And he attempts to prove this from the Torah itself, and even from Chazal. He doesn't try to prove logically or anything like that, but simply based on text that the Torah recognizes the existence of Parashat Baal Peh. I just gave you a couple examples. In fact, he doesn't think it's possible to understand even Pshat in the Torah without the oral law, so therefore it must have been there from the beginning. This would be a very good book in yeshivas to study. This leads me now to the area of halacha. He was a rav of a community, of Vorno. So obviously, on a daily basis, he's deciding matters in halacha. But he did not publish in halacha, generally. He published his biblical commentaries. Writing his philosophical works, his theological work. He has one work of halacha published posthumously, published by his children. And then we have some responsa in various volumes. There is, just to give you an example, there is a, by the 19th century, you don't have much in the way of halacha by the Italian rabbis. I don't know if ever in charge. Tech support, if you can show them, can you close my face up? We don't have much in the way of halachic writings. There are a few. Basically, the halachic tradition, in the 19th century, you don't have great halachic scholars, with one exception maybe in Italy. Certainly by the late 19th century, you don't. The rabbis are technicians, like most of the rabbis we have. If you need to know what halacha is, you open up a Mishnah Berurah or Aruch HaShulchan. You can determine halacha, but we're not dealing with independent thinkers. So the rabbis of Italy knew enough to tell you what the halacha was, but there weren't any great yeshivas left there. There weren't any great Talmudic scholars. And truthfully, you didn't need that in Italy. Just like in 1950s America, great rabbis to give the shiurim on a high level, most And today you don't need it, except if you're in a place like Teaneck or cities where everyone is quite learned. But you did have some volumes. You had, for example, there's a volume published by the rabbi of Ancona, Italy, called Vayan Yitzhak. His name was Yitzhak Rafaela Ashkenazi. I don't have my map anymore. My map disappeared, but if I were able to pull it up, I'd be able to show you that Ancona is it's on the water. It used to be part of the Papal Lands, a papal port city. In fact, it was in Ancona, Italy, that when the Pope, this is in the 17th century, 16th century, when he burnt some former conversos at the stake, Dona Gracia Nasi declared a ban, a cherem, on the city of Ancona. And this created a big dispute because some rabbis said you have to boycott everything from Ancona, but many other rabbis said no because there were Jews living there. In any event, there's a rabbi there, and he has an interesting question, which Ben Amozig also was asked about, and so we have the response of Ben Amozig. The question was, you had a community in which they insisted on shortening the davening, and they were insistent they only wanted to do one Shmoneh Esrei. We know this tradition of one Shmoneh Esrei. When I did my classes on Rav Shalom Mesas, I spoke about the Moroccan tradition of Ibn Musaf, not in Shacharis, just in Musaf, as far as I know, it never was in Shacharis, of just doing Shemoneh Esrei together. It's said out loud, and you do Kedusha, and the Chazan continues, and you continue together with him out loud. I believe that's how they did it in Morocco. The Rambam already speaks about this. Yeah, just do the Chazar HaSashat. That's all they do. And if you go to the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue today, they do this. I was there a few years ago for Musaf, and I start davening Musaf, and the Chazan starts saying it, and I didn't know what I'm supposed to do. Are you supposed to read it along with him? Are you supposed to do it quietly? Is it only for people who don't know? But that was the Moroccan tradition. This goes back to the Rambam, as we said. The Rambam instituted this as a decree, and the reason was, he says, it was a Chil Hashem. People were talking during the repetition of Shemoneh Esrei, no one was paying attention, and it looked bad in front of the Muslims, and therefore he got rid of it. I think in some of our Orthodox shuls, we could do the same thing. There's so much talking. So you had this shul who wanted to shorten the davening, and he only wanted to do one Shemoneh Esrei. So now the problem is, there's two ways you could do this. One way you could do it the old way, the way they used to do it in Morocco, and there was other, not just in Morocco, Egypt, other places, where you just have the Chazaras HaShatz and you say it along with them. That's one way. The other way you could do it is like we do what we call the Hecha Kedusha, where you start off and then you say and then everyone says it quietly. Actually, Ben Amozig has a third option. Now, Ashkenazi, this Rabbi Rafael Ashkenazi, thought that it was best to get rid of the silent Shemoneh Esrei. If you have to get rid of one, there's no choice here. Maybe in the shuls you're in, the rabbi can tell you what to do. But in this place in Italy, we asked the question, the rabbi didn't tell him, the people told the rabbi what to do, and they said, we have to get rid of one of these Shemoneh Esrei, and therefore the question was, which one to get rid of? So Rabbi Ashkenazi thought, get rid of the silent Shemoneh Esrei, just say every, the Chazan will say it all out loud, people don't know it, we'll follow along with him. That's the point of the original repetition of Shemoneh Esrei, people don't know. And the others, they can do it on their own, whatever. Ben Amozig, however, see, Ashkenazi sent his responsum to Ben Amozig. And Ben Amozig replies, and he thinks just the reverse. He thinks that the silent Shemoneh Esrei is very important. And he's arguing, really not halachically, he's arguing like a theologian, although he cites halachic sources. The silent Shemoneh Esrei is so important because that's when you stand alone before God. And therefore, we cannot take this away from people. The best thing is to daven silently. That's what we need, to be connecting to God. So you see already from this, the religious spirit is affecting his halachic decision. And he says that everyone should daven silently, and when the Chazan reaches right before Kedusha, he raises his voice and the community says it together with him. So you see, this is not the Hecha Kedusha. The Hecha Kedusha we do is when the Chazan says it out loud and we say it along with them. Although I've seen some people, they don't say it along with them. They just stand there and then the Chazan says Kedusha and then they start over. That's wrong. You should say it along with him. Because this is part of like a quasi-Chazaras HaShatz. And at least I think it's wrong. I know the Rav held that there was a Kima Mitzvah in Chazaras HaShatz. That's why these followers of Roy Soloveitchik actually stand for the whole Chazaras HaShatz. But there's other sources that would say that you're supposed to say it together with him, then you do Kiddush, and then you do it on your own. And Amozek says, no, the whole thing is quietly. And then the only thing you say out loud is you start doing Kedusha. And that reminds me of in some shuls they do in Rosh Hashanah, in Yom Kippur, the tekiyas. In Rosh Hashanah, the tekiyas are in the Sanglash Monastery, not like in the Ashkenazic Minyanim that most of us go to, where you do it all at one time. Instead, during the Shmon Esrei, during the silent Shmon Esrei, they will recite tekiyas. Put in the repetition of the Shmon Esrei, everyone comes together. Everyone, because the Chazan sang it, and then you get to a certain point where everyone gets ready and they say it. By the way, let me tell you a little chiddush, not a chiddush, just about the Kiyas HaShofar, which I have told this to numerous people, rabbis. No one has been able to tell me if I'm wrong. In fact, they all just shrug their shoulders and say, you're right. But nothing seems to change, so tell me. If you tell me I'm wrong, I'm willing to accept it. But every single year, rabbi will get up and say right before the Chazan's meditation, before we're going to Tekiyas HaShofar, that from the time of Tekiyas HaShofar until the end of Shmona Esrei, you can't talk. And this creates all the problems because the kids are coming in and everything. And I say that is not true at all. The only halacha is the first 30. It's really not 30, it's less, but we're machmer, we do 30. Everything else is minhag. The ones we do at the end, the ones we blow at the end to get to because of other of Sisra, whatever the reason given, the extra, how many we do there? I don't even know. I remember how many we do in total. But those are all just minhag, and minhag is nice, and minhag is important, and we do it. But there's no hefsek here. Once we do the initial blasts, tkiya, trua, shorim trua, once we do all that, we fulfill the mitzvah, midya raisa, and midya rabbana, and everything else is just a minhag. So what's all this stuff that you can't talk afterwards? They're fine. You shouldn't talk during davening at all. But if you have to talk, you have to do something, you have to go out, there's no hefsek here. Tell me if I'm wrong. I'm willing to accept it. But I've told this to people greater than me, and no one can give me an answer to it. And it just seems, unless I'm wrong, that this is just something the rabbis get up and say, but it's not true at all. There's absolutely no hefsek once you finish... so Shlomo tells me I'm correct. There you go. So, I'll be Shnei Edim, two witnesses. So Ben Amozig says that, like I said, you say it quietly. And then we have Ashkenazi disagrees with him. Ashkenazi says, how can you do this? Everyone davens at a different pace. So if we say the three brachos before Kedusha, we're all saying, if all of a sudden the Chazan starts, Nikadesh, I could still be in the middle. That's no good. You can't have a situation like that. You need to have everyone doing it together. So I don't know. If we had a situation like this, this would be a good question. If for some reason you had to... I guess I know the answer if we had to do it. We do it in Yeshiva. The Hecha Kedusha. It's a compromise, actually, between Ashkenazi and Ben Amozek. We do up into Kedusha, we do it out loud. And maybe the reason we do it out loud is precisely because of what Rabbi Ashkenazi said, that otherwise people won't be ready for Kedusha. They'll be at different times, but then afterwards we do it silently. And that's what Ben Amozek said, you should do the entire Shmona Esrei because it should be a personal thing between you and God. Okay, Neil says... okay, maybe it's low pull, but that would be an example of where we have these things where the rabbis say things, not for halachic reasons, but because the people are too stupid, or we don't want to let the people know about certain things. It's called halacha v'ein morin kein. The Gemara already talks about these things that technically are permitted, but we don't tell people about it. Rav Schechter mentions in Nefesh HaRav, he gives a good example of this. In his shir, this goes back to the 50s, I think, or maybe the 60s, he told the Bacharim that you can eat Kraft cheese because the rennet was vegetable and he had a different understanding of what Gevinas Akum is. Today, no one holds by this. It's just the only... You can go to the shop right and you could see non-kosher cheese with the tablet K. That's Rabbi Safra. And I once spoke to this Rabbi Safra, who's not a foolish person. He's a Reitz graduate. It's not that he's a fraud or anything. He's just still doing what they did in the 50s. But this was an unusual view of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Most people assume that cheese is not like milk. And the milk, it doesn't matter. Milk, if you know, there's no non-kosher, you can eat it. You don't even need a rabbi. You don't need these hashgachas on milk. Oh, you, the government's hashgacha. But cheese, almost everyone assumes that cheese is different. It's more of a technical thing, and it's called gevina sakum. But the Rav didn't feel that way. So Rabbi Schachter quotes him as telling the guys, though, that don't tell that to Balabatim. Don't tell it to the others, people. This is an example of halacha ve'morin kein. This is the law, but we don't tell the masses, because the masses won't be able to distinguish. They'll then all of a sudden start eating all different types of cheeses. Incidentally, I called up Kraft a couple years ago, and today they told me that the rennet is animal rennet. So even his heter won't apply today. But then there's an example of, and there's other, we have all rabbis, pulpit rabbis, know about halacha ve'morin kein. So you're right, Neil. Maybe it's precisely because of that. But I don't think the rabbis think that. They get up and they say, it's a hefsek. It's a hefsek. That leads to the question. If they don't think it's a hefsek, are you allowed to lie to your community to keep them on the proper path? That's already in machlokas among the Chassam Sofer and Rabbi Zihir Shchayas. Are you permitted to tell the community a lie to keep them religious? I think next semester we will do an Chassam Sofer. I want to get ready for this trip, which God willing, and not just God willing, but the people listening, they will want to join us on what should be a wonderful and very educational trip to Central Europe. And we're going to go to Pressburg, Bratislava. So we need to talk about the Chassam Sofer, and in preparation for that, one of the people I'll do, I think, next semester is the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer famously coined the phrase "L'halot et ha'isur," that the rabbis can raise the level of isur. It's a derabanan. You could tell them it's a reisa, or that's how some people understand it. It's not so clear. But certainly he says that if it's questionable whether this is the halacha, some say yes, some say no, you can basically tell them straight out, this is the halacha, without letting them know that there's a dispute. We'll get to that. I now want to talk about some other aspect of this halachic side, the one halachic book that Ben Amozig wrote. And it has to do with a great dispute that broke out in Italy about the propriety of cremation. And before getting to the nitty-gritty, just imagine what would happen if we were in America and Canada today and there were no Torah scholars, great Torah scholars, to provide guidance. And basically, I'm not talking about the Haredi world today because they're in a different type of situation, but let's say the rabbis coming out of YU and YCT had no rabbinic figures of any great stature to turn to, and basically they could do their own thing. And I tell you that there are some on the left wing of Orthodoxy who have this conception that when someone gets smicha, he's a rav, he's a maradasra, he can do what he wants. You hear this all the time. He's in his own community, he's the maradasra, he can do what he wants. This is so wrong historically. Forget about ideologically, this and that. Leave that to the rabbis to argue. And I myself have heard it, because I'm in this company a lot. You know, he's the Rav, he's the Maradasra, he can make any decision. Historically, it has never been this way. On the contrary, and you have a famous response of the Rush, where he writes to a rabbi. This rabbi is not some little rabbi, he's also a great rabbi, and the Rush tells him, this rabbi was trying to be very pious, he didn't want to establish an Erev in his community, and the Rush says, if you don't establish the Erev, I'm going to put you in a Cherem, because who are you to say that, you know, you're saying that there's no such thing as an Erev, and we have throughout Jewish history, always had a conception that whereas, yes, you have a notion of a marad asra, that is, the rabbi decides things, but there are certain issues that are greater, they don't just affect the local community, they have broader implications. Even Gedolei Yisrael, remember great Gedolei, Rabbi Yitzchak of Weinberg, he was not prepared to make a decision on a matter of stunning before Shlita, precisely because it would have an impact outside of Germany, and Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski, who was afraid that Rabbi Weinberg might make it, decided to intervene and interfere. So, you have never had a conception where, despite what the left says, that local rabbis have autonomous fiefdoms. At best, if you have a local issue that has no implications for outside, you could say that he's the Marad Asra and someone can't come from in from outside and tell what to do. That we do have a tradition. We also have important precedents where great figures, Gedolim, when they were asked questions, they would say that's for the local Marad Asra to decide. Rabbi Soloveitchik, if he was asked a question, refused to give the answer. He says, if you can get the Marad Asra to speak to me, I'll speak to him, but otherwise I'm not going to interfere. But if it's not just a local matter, if it'll have broader implications, you always had interference. So let's imagine a situation where you didn't have broader rabbinic guidance, and the YCT rabbis could basically do whatever they wanted, you would have somewhat of a free-for-all. Rabbis on their own, coming up with their own decisions and everything, and you'd have lots of liberal rulings. You'd have all sorts of interesting things happening. Well, that's what the case was in Italy. In Italy, you didn't have any great rabbinic figures in the late 19th century. So you had rabbis, each of them thinking they're the Maradasra, they can make the decisions on their own. You had this in America in the 1950s. Rabbis on synagogues. Rabbi Fields, he wants to have a late night Friday service. He'll have a late night Friday service. He wants to do this, that, take down the machitza. I mean, he had all sorts of things going on there. You didn't have, this is really, I'm thinking in the 30s and 40s, even the 50s, before Rabbi Soloveitchik becomes such an important figure. Like the conservative movement, exactly. You had that in Italy. You see the beginnings of this, I think, perhaps in 1865, when the rabbi of Turin, in Italy, published his opinion that we could shorten the mourning day to 3 days. 3 days! Today, it's difficult, people want to go back to work, so instead of Shiva, let's have it 3 days, Shlosha. Today, the conservative Jews, Reform Jews, they call it Shiva, they do it 2 days, 3 days, whatever they do. But it's almost unheard of, is in my experience, to find non-Orthodox people doing Shiva, actually seven. Ben Amozig immediately responds. This is 1865, and he's quite young then, or middle-aged, and he gets 11 other Italian rabbis to sign a declaration against this. Now, this rabbi in Turin is not a reformer. This is a regular rabbi, but on his own, he looked at the sources, and he thought there was room to make it 3 days. Had Italian rabbis even earlier in the century, that we can get rid of Yom Tov Sheni. And the others said, you can't do this. And the rabbis from Central Europe wrote to them and said, you can't do this. The same situation happened in France. You didn't have Gadol Yisrael in France at the turn of the 20th century. So the rabbis in France came up with this like agreement that before you marry, it's dependent on the civil government. So therefore, if you refuse to give a get, the marriage is ex post facto invalid. And the Rabbanim of Eastern Europe published a book in opposition to this. A whole book against this. Ancient Ivan Nisuin. I think that's what it is. These were not reform rabbis. These were rabbis, but they weren't the greatest Talmidei Chachamim. They thought that they could. In fact, I think it's in Rav Chaim Moser Grzynski's letter to them, he says that these things have to be left to the Gadol Yisrael. That you local rabbis, you can't decide, you know, that you're all of a sudden you're going to have a new thing that if you don't give a divorce, the marriage is ex post facto invalid. I mean, these are serious matters, marriage and divorce. So you had well-meaning rabbis in Italy and France and in America who, on their own, would come up with these ideas. The rabbi in Turin had a few other rabbis to agree with. But this was the great criticism of the YU rabbis. YU rabbis were all members of things like the New York Board of Rabbis and the Synagogue Council of America, and the right-wing rabbis, the Aguda rabbis, were saying, and just like in Italy, they were saying that you individual rabbis, you're just pulpit rabbis, you're not Talmidei Chachamim, you're making these decisions on your own, you have to now submit to the Gadol Yisrael. That's why it was so important. Soloveitchik came on board and said, no, he doesn't think there's any halachic problem with being a member of these organizations. Synagogue Council of America certainly said, New York Board of Rabbis, he didn't publicly say, but privately it was known that he wasn't in opposition to his students being part of it. So when you, all of a sudden, when you have a good old Yisrael, like Rav Soloveitchik, who after the Rosh Yeshiva in 56 came out against it, that gave protection to the rabbis. But before Rav Soloveitchik said this, it was really much, very much parallel to what was going on in Italy. You had the rabbis saying that they don't see any problem with it. What could be the problem? We're not discussing religion. We're just getting together to discuss matters that affect the Jewish community. And then you had the Rosh Yeshiva saying that, including Rosh Yeshiva from YU, Rav David Lifshitz, or Mendel Zak, saying it's forbidden. And the reason you don't see it, rabbis, is because you're not great Talmudic scholars. You don't see this as a problem. You're giving legitimacy to them. And then Rabbi Soloveitchik gave them cover. So it's really very much parallel. Now, the thing about Avevos is that the laws from Avevos of mourning are not from the Torah. So that already is going to give you a possibility for leniency. And we also know that in medieval times, certain halachot, black letter law, real halachot that you find in the posting in the Talmud, are ignored. One of the most famous ones is that according to halacha, we're supposed to turn over our beds. A little hard for us to do it, I guess, but maybe you turn over the mattress. Turn over the beds when you're in mourning. And we know that in medieval times they didn't do it. Why they didn't do it? Who can say? Tosos gives a reason. As is often the case with Tosos, this is probably an ex post facto reason, not the... Sometimes with Tosos, the reasons he gives are his way of explaining it, but that doesn't mean it's the actual reason. It's just his limud schus. He says that our beds are constructed in such a way we can't physically turn them over. Was that the reason they stopped doing it? And even if it is, it's not such a good reason, because if this is halacha, you'd say, well, don't make your beds this way. Make your beds in a way that you can turn them over. Obviously, the people started doing it, doing what they wanted to do. In fact, Rabbi Soloveitchik claims, this is in the book Out of the Whirlwind, page 9, that the practicing of covering the mirrors that we do, which no one knows the reason why you do this, on the internet, you find 1,000 different reasons. I think one of the standard reasons is that we're not supposed to be concerned about the way we look during this, whatever. That everyone knows you cover the mirrors, even if you don't do any of the halachos. And you cover the mirrors. Find this in Reform and Conservative households. Rabbi Soloveitchik says that the covering of the mirrors came to take the place of turning over the beds. That this sort of, they couldn't turn the beds over, so they wanted to do something else, so they turned the mirror over. Our covering the mirror, it's like you're turning it over. So I see it's already 10 o'clock. When we pick up next class, we're going to get into the dispute over cremation. Which itself is interesting because there's nowhere in the Talmud and nowhere in the Torah that says you can't cremate a body. So you had the Italian rabbis saying it's time, why don't cremate the bodies? And that's where Rav Elio ben Amozig, he writes this book, which is only published after his death, a rejection of this, and we will talk about this dispute next time, and lots of other interesting things, I hope. So does anyone have any comments or questions? We've done a lot today. Chadash, yeah, chadash. There's so many of these things where the people stop doing it, and the rabbis have to find a justification for it. But in Avegos, you have a number of these things. And therefore, the rabbis in Italy who wanted to be Mako were saying, as it is, there are people. And it could be that there are people in Italy who weren't being so mockpit. The masses weren't being so mockpit on Shiva as it is. And if they thought there was room to be lenient here. If people start going to work, what are you going to do? Are you going to find a heter for them? That sort of thing. So that was the mindset. Okay, we'll stay on a few more minutes. I see some more people typing. Someone just type in, by the way, how was the sound tonight? I know last week, unfortunately, there were some technical problems, which happen every now and then. Let me know. Someone just write it in. Tell me the sound was good. Everything was clear. No one contacted me otherwise, so good, very good, thank you. Lots of people typing, so we're going to get a few things. In the meantime, I'll tell you that next class, among the things I want to do at the beginning of the class, and I just assume that many people find this interesting and enjoyable because I get a lot of emails, Dafka, because of the first 10 minutes, my table talk, as it were, Derech Agav, or Rav Chaim Moser Grozinski, some great stuff from Tzvi Yehuda Cook, all that I came across during the summer, stuff dealing with, we spoke about this, ransoming captives such as Gilad Shalit. Okay, well, it says people are typing, they're not, so I will give one more minute, and... Bill, what do you think about this thing? Maybe it's Chabad. It goes back to the Alter Rebbe that it's usher to be stupid, to be foolish. Ah, okay, I will try not to lean forward. It's good to know. Okay, Yisrael's typing. I'll wait till Yisrael, and then if not, I will... Yeah, the problem is that, Yisrael, conservative Judaism is a label. it's many things that if you took what Ramosha Feinstein wrote, some of his responses, and you had, let's say, Louis Ginsberg write it, it would be a tactic of conservative Judaism. Often is very unclear. Let me tell you a great story. When I was in yeshiva, in that year in Israel that I spoke about right at the beginning, it was in Rav Dovid Miller's year, and we were learning Hilchos Sefer Torah. Everyone has to write a Sefer Torah. And we learned the famous view of the Rush. That the Rush says that today we no longer need to write a Sefer Torah for ourselves because we buy Sfarim, and that takes the place. And the point of writing a Sefer Torah is to study it, and now we buy Sfarim. And a friend of mine raised his hand and says, how is this different from conservative Judaism? There's a halacha found in all the early sources that you need to write a Sefer Torah, and the Rush says, well, we don't really need to write it. It's enough to buy books. And to his credit, Rabbi Miller sat for probably 30 seconds, maybe a minute, silently, and replied, I don't know. That he doesn't know. And there are characteristics. I mean, conservative Judaism begins as a halachic movement. They use trends that are found in our tradition. It is often hard to know where the dividing line is, and if you've read my Saul Lieberman, which I think you have, you know that at times they were very close. When you get to certain decisions, you can see a break orthodoxy. For example, the driving to shul on Shabbos decision. They have to acknowledge that it's a takana, that that technically you can't justify driving to shul on Shabbos, although they say there's larger concerns, that they want to keep continuity, but at the end they say really it's an ordinance that they need to do this. And after that decision, things start really go downhill for them, but many things that Orthodox rabbis, you can find parallels in conservatives. So it's usually given as an attack on people because they, you know, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg and Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was attacked for being like conservative or being reformist about his AID tshuva, about his other things. I mean, they didn't, there's a whole sefer. Ron Eliyahu wrote, I spoke about him, I did it for Moshe Feinstein, who thinks that Rabbi Moshe Feinstein is a great reformer. That he's trying to matter everything. So it's often in the eyes of the beholder. When I, on this trip to Hungary, which God willing we will take, we will meet with the Rav of Hungary, Rav Baruch Oberland. He's been in Hungary now for a number of years. He grew up in America, in Williamsburg. He told me that when he was young, they thought that Rav Moshe Feinstein was the Pope's sake for just the modern Orthodox, because he was some liberal, some leftist. They thought he was like, just like people in the center think of Chovei Torah, they thought Rav Moshe Feinstein was really, he wasn't really a reputable Pope's sake. He was for the, us people on the left. So it all depends on your perspective. Yes, Rav Herschel Schechter has said that. And you've had some amazing talking from him about children. If the parents are frum, but they're crazy, or you have one parent, they get divorced, one parent is normal, and one parent is frum, and the frum parent is crazy, that you should be with the non-frum parent. Because, you know, frum credit is important, but crazy is, you can't be crazy. I mean, you can always... you know, you can come back from not being religious, but if you're raised in a crazy household, then what can you do? Shalom Asani Goy. Okay, those are the tough ones. You have Orthodox synagogues that do that. You have Orthodox synagogues that don't say it. If you go to KJ, they won't say it out loud. It's not so much for the Goy as much for the Isha. They found a source in a French posek, Rabbi, name, the Rav of Metz, Rabbi, I forgot the name of the Sefer, it's a volume Sefer, the name was Worms. He wrote that already in his day they wouldn't say Shalos HaNeisha out loud, but I don't know. I was in the synagogue where they did that, and I was very uncomfortable with it, taking it out. But I don't know. In that synagogue, by the way, they davened. They read the Torah. It was a minyan, more than a minyan than a synagogue. They read the Kriyas Torah facing the community. So I said to the person afterwards, he's one of my former students. I said to him, "How can you read Kriyas Torah facing the shul?" that's what the conservatives do. And he said it's not against halacha. And I said, of course it's not against halacha, but it's also not against halacha to come on Shabbos in jeans or to stand on the chair while you're davening, but it goes against the minhag. We don't turn the Torah around and face the community. That's what the conservatives did. And then he said to me, though, that there was loads of people in that shul. There's probably 30, 40 people. Most of them hadn't been to shul in 10, 15 years. Not happy with the conservative shul. They hadn't. And here they were going to shul. And that they were comfortable with because they remember that. So, you know, when you hear that he's bringing all these people into shul who haven't been to shul in many years, and he feels he needs to have a situation with a little compromise like this, Kriyas HaTorah facing the people, that's the sort of thing, compromise, that, you know, I think it's worth making. The line is murky, as you say. Okay, well, with that, thank you very much. Look forward to seeing everyone next week. Good night.